The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 268.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. Forget Jeff Gunlock. I've got the real bond king right here, Mr. Stephen Van Meter. Stephen, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Hey, George. Good to see you, buddy. Glad to be back.
Now, tell me about what's going on in the markets. I know you follow this stuff daily. I kind of try to look at things more from a 30,000 foot level. But what are your overall views? And then we'll kind of hone in on the details. But just one thing I've been looking at that's really surprising is, probably not surprising to you, is since April, you know, we saw the repo spike, bringing the bank reserves down into the reverse repo accounts, so the banks don't have access to it. And sure enough, we see the 10-year going pretty much straight down since then. So what are your thoughts on that and the whole inflation, disinflation, deflation thing we got going on?
Yeah, you know, George, I think the story right now is this whole reverse repo thing.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people really understand it. I think they want to, and their assumption is that rates should go up. And like you just pointed out, you can almost time the exact bottom or the top in yields right now with the beginning of reverse repo problem.
Yeah.
And so that whole begs a whole question, you know, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, and M2. I don't know if you're a big fan of M2 or the new way they measure it. I know Snyder hates it. You know, he thinks it's basically worthless.
You know,
I don't know if you're
funny about that. He finds a lot of things super worthless, but I think guys like you and I still like them.
Yeah, well, it's just like, it's like the only thing you got. You know, I realize that it's not that great. And I realize there are a lot of dollars out there that are being created or destroyed in the euro dollar market. And that's probably a lot more significant than what we see here domestically or what the Fed can actually quantify. But it's all we got. So we kind of got to use it as a little bit of a guidepost. At least that's kind of how I look at it. So, but I noticed too that M2, at least their version of it, it leveled off starting in April as well. Did you notice that?
Yeah, the year over year rate of change is really what I look at, because the assumption is the money supply should grow. I mean, it's naturally should be growing at, you know, 6-7% a year, something like that. So I'm more interested when it's growing above that or below. And the year over year rate of change is actually declining. It won't be till tomorrow. And I know this show won't air that quick, but tomorrow we'll see it. And my expectation is a year over year rate of change should continue to decline. And it makes sense, because you think about where was all this money that was coming into the checking and savings accounts? Well, it was coming from government stimulus. So we know the direct to consumer stimulus is gone. We know some of the unemployment, extended unemployment benefits are gone. And we know more of that is coming. So,
and no, that's Steve, but the eviction moratoriums and the mortgage forbearance. I know I did a video today on the eviction moratoriums ending in less than, I think, 10 days or so.
Yeah, that all of that stuff is going to hit. And then you think September 6th, the extended unemployment benefits go away. I think at the end of September, the moratorium on student loan payments goes away. So all of a sudden, you see this cash that's kind of piled up, and you know, we're kind of sitting back looking at it like, well, that's not going to last.
Right. And you think that's what the bond market's telling us, at least the 10-year?
Yeah, I think the bonds market is telling us that financial conditions are tightening, and the average person doesn't really understand the bond market much, and they don't know what that means. It just means there is a natural shortage of dollars. And I know you understand that, George. And what that means for some of your fans who don't really, or maybe you're just hearing this for the first time, is I like to think of our dollar system like a game of musical chairs. There's so many chairs, but there's always more people. The music stops, someone loses. And think of the chairs as dollars and the people, well, as people. And that's why even when times are good, right? You know, people, when real estate is booming, I know that's your bread and butter, that there's other people that are going broke. And it's kind of like, how can you go broke when so many people are doing good? Well, that's the game. There's a dollar shortage. There's always losers. The question is, are there more losers than normal? And what we see with the bond market, it's telling us that there's fewer dollars than we actually need to keep the system really going. And as interest rates fall, the whole point of that is to spur lending growth. This is really where we get the creation of dollars from, not from the Fed, kind of as your hat kind of suggests that, you know, the Fed really doesn't help us much. We get it through the creation of new loans. And so interest rates are trying to fall right now to create lending growth, to get borrowers to go in the banks and borrow money. And it's not happening. So what that's telling us is that financial conditions are tightening. There is a dollar shortage, or as Jeff Snyder would tell us, it's more of a euro dollar issue, which we would both nod our head and agree. And that's what we're seeing right now.
So why is there a dollar shortage? Can you explain that to someone that doesn't understand that? Because they're, you know, hearing money printing go, or money printer go burr and all this stuff, and they're seeing the Fed's balance sheet and M2 for that matter, you know, rightfully so, going just completely parabolic.
Right.
You're saying, okay, well, what are the principles behind what you're saying?
Yeah, and the best way to explain that is to go back to how the very first dollar came into the system. And the Fed didn't print the first dollar. The first dollar was lent into existence.
Right.
And with that loan meant someone had to pay interest on.
Right.
So the first question someone should ask is, well, if the first dollar was borrowed into existence, where would that person get the interest to repay the loan?
Right. So there's not enough dollars out there to pay back the loan plus interest because the dollars have been created through lending itself.
Right. And that's what's brilliant about our system. If people ever wonder why they feel like they can never get ahead or why we're always having to work to chase money, is because we are. There just isn't enough of it. Some people say Jeff Bezos, extremely good at attracting money, maybe probably the best there is right now. And then there's a lot of people that aren't good at it. And every day we go to work and we all compete with our skills or abilities to get as many dollars as we can. And that's the game. Some people are always going to be short, and it's not their fault. You know, I mean, maybe they're a hard worker, maybe they're really smart and they just can't get the dollars. Well, welcome to the game. There's only so many, and certain people are just much better at getting it than they are.
And sometimes that debt is completely overwhelms the individuals. Doesn't that have to do with velocity? Because if velocity's there, you know, you can pay back, let's say, $10 of debt with $5, but you've got to have velocity.
Absolutely correct. So let's just talk about normally, and then we can talk about the velocity. So if everybody right now took all of their money and paid off their debt, and then the people that had excess money paid off everyone else's debt, we have more debt than we have dollars. So what we really need, as you mentioned, is velocity, or the amount of times money changes hands, to increase. Because then if I get a dollar, I can pay on a debt. But if that dollar can move to you, you can pay on a debt, and that dollar moves on to, say, Snyder, then he can do. And then the more it moves, the more people can benefit from that dollar.
Yeah.
But when it doesn't move, well, now you have a really big problem. And that's what we're seeing right now, is there is, oddly, from the M2, as you mentioned, a whole lot of these dollars out there. They ain't moving. I mean, it's like molasses.
Yeah. So another way to say that might be economic activity, not just, you know, dollars going from one person to another. And the reason I say economic activity, because that leads me to think, okay, well, the government has a lot to do with this, not only from the standpoint of kind of creating dollars, let's say, like they did in 2020, and now creating fewer of those dollars to make up for the lack of dollars being created by the banking system or the euro dollar system. But if they impose, let's just say, a massive amount of regulation, let's say we turn into communist Russia or something like that, that would decrease velocity. That's going to, because it's going to decrease economic activity. The system isn't producing as many goods and services, not as many jobs, not as much productivity. And therefore that would decrease that velocity as well. Am I right to think that, or what do you think?
You're on the right path, but there's one thing you're missing, though.
Okay.
And that is the question is, why aren't all these dollars moving? Because we're seeing it, right? We see it in the M2. There's a lot of dollars sitting there.
Mm.
And that, and again, just to restate, the M2 is your checking and savings accounts. The question is, why isn't it moving? And that's the problem. And the reason comes back to quantitative easing. And what it does, and it creates what I call a dollar prison in the commercial banking system. And because, and we can get into that, but due to the lack of commercial banks that participate in the Federal Reserve system, they just can't move very much. I mean, think of it as, you know, you've got a 5-unit condo and you have a tenant who wants to move between them. Well, they're going to be in one of the five. But now let's go to Las Vegas and one of those big mega casinos. Well, they want to change rooms. Great. We got lots of floors and lots of rooms. We can move you around all you want. And the problem is quantitative easing traps dollars in the system. So what we think should be all these dollars moving around, we look at the velocity of money, we can actually see they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say, okay, Steve, I get it, the velocity's down. But at the end of the day, velocity is just a measurement of using M2 and GDP, which is probably another flawed metric, you know. But I've seen the prices of everything around me, and I'm one of those people, you know, I've seen the price of almost everything I buy has gone up dramatically in the last year. So when you're referring to deflation or inflation or disinflation, I think it's important that we define exactly what you're referring to, because we can have a situation like the 1970s, as an example, where we have consumer price inflation, but we have, you know, the stock market go down by 50% in nominal terms from 72 to 74. So you have significant asset deflation. So how would you define it? And then what if you still believe that, you know, we're in a deflationary or disinflationary environment, what would you say to that person that says, my goodness, Steve, everything I'm buying is just going through the roof?
Yeah, and that's a great point, George. It really is, because what we're seeing is supply chain disruptions from the pandemic. And so what happened is people were effectively paid more money to go at home. You know, I just spoke with one of my clients today, and they said, you know, we got the stimulus checks, but Steve, honestly, we didn't need them. I mean, why were they giving them to us? And so what happened is people spent it, and we just drained the shelves of goods and services to the point where there was nothing. And then because the world was shut down, they couldn't be replenished. And now, because as we kind of talked about earlier, the extended unemployment benefits, there's a lack of desire for some people to even want to go back to work because it means they're going to earn a lower wage. So there is a benefit to staying on the system. And, you know, I get it. If I was in that situation, I probably would too. And so we don't have people going back and, you know, into the mines and into the factories and in the workforce and into transportation to bring these goods and services, to produce them and bring them to market. And so we are getting inflation from that. Now, that's a lot different than the 1970s, which is really fascinating because there's now a big comparison, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we're seeing the 70s again, but the 70s had a couple unique events. One, we went off the dollar or the gold standard onto the dollar standard. And what we learned is, because it had a large number of banks at the time, which is one of the key things you need to create inflation. If you want dollars to move, you need a lot of banks. And we don't have a lot of banks now compared to then. I want to say there was like 10,000 type of commercial or major lending, or now I shouldn't say major lending banks, but banks that were in, you know, the commercial space. Now we have like 3,000. And in the Fed system, we have a very tiny number. Mm-hmm. And when you have a large number of banks
and a lot higher population, by the way.
Well, yeah. And then you have the baby boomers coming into the economy who had a high desire to spend and create. What we learned is that our financial system was highly inflationary in the 70s, and gold was actually keeping it at bay. It was doing exactly what the gold standard was designed to do. Mm-hmm. Today, we have a different system than we did come from the gold standard. And the system today is highly deflationary by design. And that's why you can look back since the 1980s and say, why hasn't the Fed been able to get the consumer price index to trend higher? It's in a disinflationary mode for four decades. It's because our system doesn't actually create inflation. It doesn't work. And that's a problem.
Or the system, the way it's currently set up or has been set up. I want to get to that in a moment, but let's back up a little bit here, because I think you touched on a point that was fantastic that most people really don't pay enough attention to. And I think that at least when I'm reading my comments or doing my live streams or even the mainstream financial media, everyone gets fixated on the demand side of the equation. Well, there's fewer dollars, or there's less dollars, or there's more demand, there's less demand, but they completely forget about the supply side of the equation. And the reason I say that is because you can have demand or even velocity go down while prices are going up if supply is going down a lot faster than the demand itself. It's not just if demand is going up, it can go down, but if velocity goes down a lot faster, excuse me, if supply goes down a lot faster, then you still could have those prices go up. But I would assume that you would say, well, in that environment, yes, it's possible. We just saw it happen because of the supply chain disruption. But that means that the inflation we have seen is transitory. We use Powell's quote there that everyone loves so much.
Yeah.
So you would probably agree that it's transitory in nature, because once we get those supply chains back online, then we revert to the system that we've had since we left the gold standard, or since the 1980s, which although there's two forces always at play, inflation and deflation, our system it wants to deflate. It wants to delever because the debts in the private sector and the public sector are just so high. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think you've got it pretty well there. And it's kind of interesting because the bond market is telling us we're not seeing sustainable inflation. It is transitory, because if it was, then interest rates should be rising. That is the logical and correct conclusion. So the bond market is saying, like, even if the economy doesn't fully reopen, the fact that we're going to see extended unemployment benefits cut, the moratorium on evictions and the student loans and all the other things that are probably going on that we don't even know about,
right,
are telling us that there are serious problems. Because, you know, if you look at what interest rates do, they rise and fall to absorb or create money. So if there's too much money in the system, so like the 1970s, why did interest rates go up? I think of it like a mop. You know, there's water on the floor and, oh gosh, I got to mop it up. Well, that's what interest rates do. They rose to mop up that water. Well, when they fall, they're telling us, look, we need to create water. We need to get water on the floor. There's not enough. We need to fall to get people to go in and borrow money. And this is what it's telling us right now is, yeah, this inflation is likely to be very transitory. In fact, my concern, George, is we're going to see it actually take a sharp nosedive down.
Okay, so a couple things there. One, I think a lot of the viewers would say, okay, we see the rates going down. Maybe that has something to do with reverse repo, but could it just be that it's the long end of the curve is responding to the $120 billion that the Fed is buying, or $80 billion a month in treasuries, and the Fed is creating so much artificial demand, and therefore prices going up, rates go down. And although we had a spike in rates, that's just because the market temporarily overwhelmed the additional demand created by the Fed. And now the Fed demand is overwhelming the market. Is there an argument there? Or how would you respond to that?
I say there is absolutely an argument to that that actually goes alongside with it. So yes, quantitative easing, and we'll, our buddy Jeff Snyder says it doesn't do much. I think it does more, and I look forward to one day to actually discussing that with him. But if you look at the QE purchases and then you say, okay, what are the primary dealer banks buying at auction? Because what a primary dealer bank's job is to do is buy treasuries at an auction and then resell them. They're, think of them as a wholesaler or a middleman, and they try to make a little bit of profit on that. So what I look at is the primary dealer take at an auction and what the Fed's monthly purchase of that specific, you know, security were. So we'll use today, there was a 20-year treasury auction, and the dealers bought $5 billion worth of 20-year. Well, the Fed's buying $5.7 billion a month of 20-year specifically. So it tells us that they are reducing the supply. But reverse repo is interesting because what it's doing
Steve, could you repeat those two numbers again?
Yeah.
How much did the primary dealers buy and then the Fed?
So today the primary dealers took $5 billion on the 20-year auction.
Got it.
The Fed is buying $5.7 billion a month.
Okay. So
the Fed is buying more supply than the dealers are getting, which would imply that the dealers have to go out to the open market and pick up $700 million more of 20-year to sell to the Fed, which does mean that rates go down and bond prices go up, which is what QE
and reduces M2 money supply.
Yeah, it does actually feed because QE is what QE does is suppress rates, right? And when you suppress rates as a saver, so if you've got a lot of money in savings, one thing you'll do, which is really interesting, is you'll look to put your money out for a longer term. Now, it could mean you'll buy a CD, maybe you'll buy some kind of bond, or who knows, you're going to buy something to earn a little bit more interest. But you know, and you're a smart guy and you invest and you save. if there's virtually no difference, right? If I said, you know, hey, George, I'm gonna either hold your money in cash and we'll just say at X percent, or I'm gonna tie your money up and I'm gonna give you 0.01 or 0.05 more to tie it up for 5 years, you're gonna be like, heck no, man, why would I do that? And that's the whole point of QE, is QE feeds off of bank deposits from customers and corporations. So it needs to create more to eat more. Well, it creates more by driving rates down. So inadvertently, you see the money supply grow because of QE, which... Well,
So what I was talking about, I'm sorry, Steve, to cut you off, but I was talking about that process in and of itself could decrease the money supply, because the way I'm thinking through that is if basically the Fed through the primary dealer banks are buying treasuries from the general public because there's a shortage that's being supplied by the primary dealer banks themselves, then that would decrease the amount of commercial liabilities in the commercial banking system, because the Joe public is having to buy those treasuries, or excuse me, they're selling treasuries. So that would increase the money supply. Yeah, I'm doing it in reverse. Yeah, that's right.
But it also depends on who they're buying it from, and if the person they're purchasing it from. So let's say they're buying it inadvertently, indirectly, and the Fed wouldn't know this, but let's say they buy it from a pension fund. Well, that pension fund, that money might not show up long enough in the money supply, because they might immediately turn around and go buy something else with it.
Yeah, I got it in reverse, because when the Fed's buying from the public, they're taking the treasuries, putting them on the balance sheet, then increasing the liabilities of the commercial banking system, because they're having to pay for those with dollars that they credit the individual's account that's in the real economy.
Yeah. So when the Fed does a QE auctions, they're only through the commercial banking system.
I'm just saying that the commercial bank, if they did that kind of hypothetically,
buy it from the dealers and the dealers buy. Yeah. You got it right. You're just cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool.
Yeah, we do want to be clear. The Fed is not going out and personally buying a bond off of me. They wouldn't do that. Now, if I sell a bond into the open market, it could eventually get back to them, but I would never know that.
Yeah, now I think the Bank of England does, don't they? If I'm getting that straight, I think they, because I've watched a few of their videos and I've read their paper about 500,000 times, that one that they did in 2014. And it seems like they kind of say, okay, well, we could buy it from the banks, but we also might just go into the open market and buy it directly from the individuals and entities in the real economy, which would directly affect the money supply. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that could. I don't know about the Bank of England, so I'll defer that you're correct. But the Fed does not do it that way.
Okay. Yeah. So they're still using the shell game with the primary dealer banks. One thing I wanted to touch base on, I'd love to get your opinion on this. You know, we kind of think through what was happening with reverse repo, and even when Snyder articulates it, you know, he's saying, well, there's a shortage of collateral, mm-hmm. which or pristine collateral, right. which makes a lot of sense. But the way I think through that is, okay, I get it. There could be an issue with the amount of pristine collateral, but at the end of the day, doesn't that have to do with the amount of counterparty risk or perceived counterparty risk? Because if there was very, very low counterparty risk in the system, then you wouldn't need that much pristine collateral. But as the perceived counterparty risk increases, then I would assume those money market fund managers would want a higher level or more pristine collateral. You know, like as an example, if you're lending to Warren Buffett, you're going to go ahead and take those mortgage-backed securities. But if you're lending to, you know, some guy on the side of the street that you don't know from Adam, the only way you're going to do a repo with him is if he's giving you the best collateral available, those T-bills. Right. Do you think there's something to that, or do you think it's just the collateral issue?
All right, I'm gonna blow your mind right here, because I'm gonna teach you something that you don't know, and you're gonna have you're gonna go, oh God, this is worse than I thought.
Okay,
okay. So and you're gonna see the brilliance of how the system gets connected. And the only question that I have, and I'll love to get your opinion when I'm done, is was this just dumb luck or absolutely brilliant by the people building policy? So in 2016, the Securities and Exchange Commission came out with money market rule 2A-7. And effectively what they did is they said they made all these new rules for money markets, And you can go through them and read them, and it says how, you know, what percentage needs to be at what duration. The net of the rule says all money market, it doesn't say this, but this is what it gets interpreted as and how it is actually is that all money markets need to be backed by T-bills. Not MBS, not anything. T-bills and T-bills only.
Hmm. Now, do they do that, or did they just kind of ignore it?
No, they do it. They did. And that's why, and you may remember, like, after sometime after, as in 2016 and following, banks and investment companies, they started changing all their money markets around. And if people like, well, what are they doing? And it was like, it doesn't matter. Well, they were reacting to this rule 2A-7 and effectively said, you can only buy treasury bills.
Now, I just want to define that. Is that for money market funds?
Yes.
And money market accounts? Or
yes,
just
same difference. Same difference. Money market, anything money market has okay. to be backed by T-bills.
Now. Okay, got it.
And so
got
you
it.
Think about what they did. It's kind of brilliant, right? They're like, man, we need to create something to deal with all this debt we have. So we'll force money markets
the public to basically buy it.
And the public doesn't even know any different, right? So right. someone listening right now is going, what? Yeah, if you own money markets, congratulations. All of your money is backed by the government debt.
Yeah.
So now the problem is, as Snyder points out, is there isn't enough T-bills in the market because the Treasury is not issuing enough for whatever bizarre reason. Janet Yellen, who knows better, I mean, we know that she knows better, is cutting the issuance of T-bills and rolling off the Treasury general account. So all of a sudden, you have a shortage of T-bills. Now, why is that? Why does that even matter? Well, because if a money market fund has, you know, $100 billion sitting in it, it's got to pay interest to its customers. And if it can't get the collateral, the interest-bearing collateral, it can't pay its customers. So it's got to go get it from somewhere. In this case, the Fed stands up and says, hey, I got 5 basis points or 0.05%. If you want that, give me your cash and I'll pay you that interest.
Right. And here's a question I had. Is the money market funds, or the majority of them, are the dollars in those funds liabilities of strictly the Fed, or are they liabilities of the commercial banking system? Because those are two, you know, big things. And where I'm going with that is, do they have access to IOER?
Of the money market fund itself.
Okay, but are those dollars, they got to be a liability of the Fed or the commercial banking system?
It's got to be the commercial banking system in the end.
Okay, so are they getting an interest rate on that? And because if they have a deposit, like even, although it might be minuscule, even I have an interest rate on my checking account, let's say, you know, so, and that's a liability of the commercial banking system. So the money market funds, were they getting any basis points at all with the money that they had parked as liability of the commercial banking system before it transferred over to a liability of the Fed only?
Well, that's the issue, is that they don't have enough T-bills to pay that interest. So what these funds do is they take that cash, that liability, and they turn it into a liability of the Treasury by buying a T-bill with it. There just isn't enough T-bills for everyone to buy. So
right.
What that does is it drives interest rates down and threatens to take the money market rate below zero, which, as you know, we can't do. That's massive no-no. Can't take the money market rate negative. But the problem is there isn't enough money to back all this cash.
There's not enough money to back the cash.
There's not enough T-bills to back the cash.
Oh, not enough T-bills to back. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Got it.
I think I misstated that.
Okay. No problem.
So the Fed, right? So this is where this is what reverse repo is purely and exactly designed to do. Is reverse repo says, if there's too much cash and not enough securities to back it, call the Fed, we'll do it. So all the Fed's doing is saying, look, you give us your cash that you have too much of. We'll give you a matching treasury security for the night, an overnight treasury security, and we'll pay 0.05% on an annualized basis. So you can turn around and scalp your minuscule amount of interest for a profit, which is nothing. They're not making any money. But so you can pay your customer, what, you know, 2 or 3 basis points, and the system keeps functioning. Otherwise, money market rates have to go negative, and then we have all kinds of pandemonium.
Why do you think T-bill rates are 3 basis points when they could just get 5 at reverse repo?
Yeah, that is a great question, because the banks still need pristine collateral. So that's something you hear Jeff talk about, right? The banks still absolutely desperately need it. So
the big banks, like the JP Morgan's, Goldman Sachs and whatnot,
right? The big banks still need it. So if you think about the problem, right, there was all this massive shortage of collateral, and who is the Fed beholden to? Commercial banking system, right? That is the children of the Fed. Got to keep them solvent. So the commercial banking system's calling the Fed, going, like, man, we don't have enough collateral, and Janet Yellen won't issue it. We need this, or we're going to take deposit rates negative. Fed goes, no, you can't do that. So the Fed says, well, we need to get collateral release from the system, right? And you did a piece on Zoltan, right? And so what he said effectively is that the money markets have T-bills. So how do you get someone to give up something they have? And that is to offer them more interest. So the Fed says, okay, we're going to do this reverse repo at 5 basis points. The money market funds are going, what are you saying? Yeah, we'll take that all day long. And so what Zoltan said is, what's going to happen is, as these T-bills mature, that the money market funds are having, they're just going to let them go, because they're happy to go get that 5 basis points. In the meantime, the commercial banks are like, oh man, there's some T-bills around. I'll take all you got. And they don't care if they're less than 5 basis points, because they need that collateral. They desperately need it.
So because they, through financial engineering, then they can get more than the, let's say, 15 basis points that they're getting in IOER. As long as they have that collateral, they, who knows what they do with it? They turn into the mortgage-backed sausage or something like that.
Yeah.
Then they make it, maybe they can eke out a 20 basis points with, as long as they have that T-bill. But if they have the bank reserves, they can only get the 15 basis points that they're getting in IOER. So you've got to look at what a money market fund manager is doing with the T-bills. And that is a lot different than what Goldman Sachs is doing with those T-bills. And meaning that the money market fund manager is only getting the T-bills just to clip the coupon, if you want to look at it that way. Where the Goldman Sachs, they don't care. They could care less about the coupon, because they're doing all this derivatives trading and what, and rehypothecating it and whatever to get their 30 or 40 basis points, where the money market fund can only get either the 3 or the 5. So there's two wildly different reasons for creating demand for those T-bills that we have to take into consideration.
You got it. And here is the brilliant part of all this, because now you might say, okay, that's like, this makes sense. The banks need collateral. The money market funds need yield. Perfect. So how does reverse repo actually like connect and make this work? Well, if you go back to that money market rule 2A-7, it says, okay, a money market fund has to have, you know, like 30% liquidity at this many days. And then it has to have 60% of this many days. Well, what is reverse repo? 100% overnight liquidity. So as far as the money market funds are concerned, they are 100% compliant with the SEC rule by offloading all their money to the Fed. It's brilliant.
Now, or maybe inadvertently brilliant.
Well, that's what I said. I would ask you, right? Did somebody actually figure this out years ago, or is it just dumb luck?
Well, I was thinking about it. That is fascinating. I'm glad you brought it up. I was thinking about it a little bit different way. I was thinking that, you know, Jerome Powell was for a while there was just getting hammered with inflation. And, you know, the balance sheet is going up, and, you know, they're creating all of these additional bank reserves through the process of quantitative easing. And he's looking at the long end of the curve, and it's going up and up and up and up and up. And he's probably getting a little concerned, to say the least, about that. He's going in front of Congress all day long. And in his mind, let's just assume that he equates the amount of bank reserves with the inflation psychology in the real economy or something like that, or the access to bank reserves that the commercial banks have, and therefore creating more dollars in the real economy or increasing the capacity of their balance sheet for further lending. And he says, okay, well, I need to keep doing QE, because if I don't do QE, then the market's going to completely tank, the stock market, and along with it will go the economy. So I can't reduce the size of our balance sheet because of the, you know, expectations policy and the psychology and the brainwashing, the manipulation that the Fed does with the market. So I can't decrease the size of our balance sheet, but we somehow need to do QT. we've got to do quantitative tightening somehow. Let's do the reverse repo. So we're taking, in essence, they're doing quantitative tightening by lowering the amount of reserves in the bank accounts of the commercial banking system by taking those out of the reserve accounts and moving those reserves down into reverse repo. And so, and then I looked at the 10-year yield and saw it starting to go down. I said, maybe they inadvertently did that and did QT on accident, and that's just what happened. Or maybe Jerome Powell deserves a little more credit, and by taking it up to the 5 basis points, he knew that those bank reserves would be depleted out of their accounts, and again, in essence, doing QT. That's kind of how I was looking at it. Do you think there's anything to that?
I don't subscribe to the QT story, although it is popular, and there is some logic to it, and that's why it makes sense to you. So let's take a different step, and maybe I want to come back to that because there is something we need to go and dig through. But let's try to figure out what Powell's real motivation was. And so after the Great Financial Crisis, we had these Basel III banking rules. I don't know how familiar or if you're even familiar with them at all.
I've done a couple of videos on them.
Okay. So effectively what the Basel III rules, there's a lot of them, but what's the key thing to them? It said, we want banks to shrink their what's called their balance sheet, which includes depository money. And if bank balance sheets grow, well, we're going to penalize them with what's called a surcharge. The bigger the banks get, the more they get to pay of this penalty. Now, banks, as you know, don't like that kind of thing because they'd rather take their money and use it to give their executives bonuses and do share buybacks. So they're getting penalized. Well, when all this stimulus hit, where did it go? Well, it actually went to Bank of America and JP Morgan because Wells Fargo's in the penalty box. Citibank doesn't really play in the resident or the consumer space, their balance sheets ballooned. And so what happens now is the bank's balance sheets are getting bigger, they're getting penalized, and they're telling Powell, we don't have the balance sheet to buy any more of these treasury securities that we know you really want us to buy. And if you don't do something, we're going to drive deposit rates negative because we're going to force the shrinkage of our balance sheet. And we're going to piss off all the customers. And I don't know. We don't know where they're going to take the money, but we want them out of our system. And if you don't do it, we'll do it for you. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden he's got a problem. He's got to get the balance sheets of the banks to shrink so they can resume buying treasury securities, which is really what he wants them to do. Mm-hmm. And maybe lend, because that would be nice too. So how do you get the banks to offload all this cash?
And, or bank reserves.
And get them the collateral they need anyways. Aha.
Yeah.
I will go and offer 5 basis points on reverse repo, knowing the money market funds are getting less than that, and it will be more than happy to do it. The banks will then immediately turn around and start converting their savings accounts to money market savings accounts. And they'll tell the customers, we got to do this. And it gives the banks a way to take all that cash on their balance sheet and dump it onto the money market, which is really, if we cut out the middleman, a sneaky way of putting it back on the Fed's balance sheet. Because effectively every night that's what's happening through the reverse repo. So I don't think the Fed was doing it from a tightening standpoint. We can get into how I think they're inadvertently tightening, but I think they're literally doing it because the banks were pissed off of, hey, we got all this money, we don't want it, and now you're penalizing us because we took all this money that you said we had to take that we didn't want.
Yeah. I think we're kind of saying the same thing, because when I think about the Fed's balance sheet, obviously there's a lot of components there to the liability side, but the three main components that I think about are the reserve accounts of the commercial banking system, or the majority of the banks there.
So so you're talking about the reserve assets, the byproduct of QE.
Yeah. The bank reserves. Okay. Yeah. The bank reserves. I just see those as the dollars that are the liability of the Fed compared to the real dollars that are circulating in the economy that are the liabilities of the commercial banking system. They're both called dollars, but they're far different. One's bank reserves. One are actually, I would consider currency, you know. Sure. And then the next account down below that, just the way I see it in my mind, is the TGA. And then the account below that is reverse repo.
The TGA isn't a Fed account. That's the government's bank account.
Yeah, but it's a liability of the Fed.
Well, some of it is. It depends on where the money's coming from, actually.
Well, when
in the end, all the money is liability of the Fed. But if, say, Bank of China buys treasury securities, well, that money isn't backed in. That money isn't backed by T-bills or anything else. It's actual cash. So the TGA is a mix of reserves and non-reserves, depending on where the money comes from. Now, in the end, it eventually gets converted to that, but it's got to flow through the system.
Yeah, basically what I'm saying. So if Janet Yellen goes out and issues, let's just say $1 billion worth of bonds, and let's just say that that's absorbed by the private sector, then what's happening is, and let's say it's all one person. Let's say Warren Buffett, right?
Yeah.
Buys all $1 billion worth, and he uses his account at Wells Fargo. Perfect. So then what would happen is those $1 billion worth of bank reserves would go from Wells Fargo's reserve account down into the TGA, which is a liability of the Fed. So that's that's what I'm talking about. Well, but then let's take it a step further.
Because there is something I want to clarify here is that there's two types of reserves. There's a bank reserve, which is created. So when Warren Buffett deposits $1 billion at Wells Fargo, the bank goes out and buys treasury securities, which is a liability of the government, of the treasury. It's not until the quantitative easing swap occurs where that money could be a liability of the Fed. So there's actually two components that are there, but they look, I mean, we could set them side by side and be like, I can't tell the difference. Well, that's the idea, but there is a difference.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Let's go down this path a little further. When I, let's say you're with B of A, I'm with Wells Fargo. When I transfer, let's say $1,000, I wire $1,000 to you or Zelle it to you or something like that. What is happening on the balance sheet of the two commercial banks, and what is happening on the balance sheet of the Fed?
So let's just assume there's no quantitative easing doesn't exist, is not
occurring. Right.
So what happens is at the end of the night, we'll assume that we're the only two customers, right? This is the only money.
Right.
And Wells needs to transfer $1,000 to B of A. What they do is they transfer reserves internally to the system.
Yet, which is a liability to the Fed.
No, there's no quantitative easing at this point. So it doesn't exist. It's a liability of the Treasury. So let's back up one step. All right. So you deposit $1,000 in B of A.
Mm-hmm.
They then turn around and take that $1,000 and buy Treasury securities, which are a liability of the U.S. government. The Fed, they don't become a liability of the Fed until the Fed buys that bank reserve through QE. Now, we don't know which ones they're buying specifically, but then the first step is it's just a liability of the Treasury, of the U.S. government. And that's where it gets super confusing, because there's actually two pieces to this, and we can't easily see the difference.
Yeah, so I understand what you're saying. I think what I usually do, and maybe I'm making a mistake, maybe I'm not, I can't wait to think this through, is I'm skipping ahead.
Right.
I'm skipping to the point where the banks actually have bank reserves. And where I was going with that, because when I see that transaction occurring in my mind, I'm thinking first and foremost that there's a liability of $1,000 going from Wells Fargo to B of A, because I'm transferring those quote unquote dollars that are in the real economy. So Wells Fargo has a liability to me that they are then transferring to Bank of America. And they can't just transfer them a liability without an asset. So right. Then what would happen, assuming now they both have bank reserves, that those $1,000 worth of bank reserves would have to go from Wells Fargo up to B of A or down or whatever, right. So that they'd have a matching, so the liabilities would match up with the assets. Right. We're saying the same thing. I think I'm taking a step ahead and not going maybe back far enough.
Well, I think the assumption,
or I'm probably not going back as far as you are.
Yeah. And the confusion is the initial step is that a deposit in a bank has to get converted to a bank reserve. A bank reserve is U.S. Treasuries initially. And then you have the quantitative easing process, which I like to use the term reserve asset, converts that bank reserve to an overnight reserve, which we'll call reserve assets, which again, it looks the same. The difference is we're switching liabilities. One's a liability of the government, the other's a liability of the Fed. So we can't say that all deposits are liability of the Fed. We can only say that up to the size of the balance sheet. Now, we don't know. Could it be my account, your account? We don't know. But there is some deposits are Fed liabilities, some are government liability, treasury liabilities.
Right, but the dollars is what I was referring to. If you have a dollar,
right,
there's a dollar.
The day, right, all dollars are liability of the Fed. I mean,
or the commercial banking system, because if you and I have dollars on our balance sheet as assets,
right,
then those dollars are our assets, but they're liabilities not of the Fed, but they're liabilities of the commercial banking system, unless we have physical paper dollars. You know?
Well, yeah, paper dollars is all. I mean, in the end of the day, everything belongs to the Fed, and it's all. Comes back there, but right, initially that those cash dollars go to the bank, which is a liability to the bank, then the bank needs to convert it to an asset, so they go and buy treasury securities. So now the bank has an asset, a treasury security, that's a liability of the government. So those dollars that were initially a liability of the bank now get transferred to liabilities of the treasury, and then the Fed comes along and buys those treasuries, and so the liability then switches from the treasury to the Fed. So in the end of the day, the dollars do get there, but not all of them, because the Fed hasn't monetized the entire banking system. I think that's what I'm trying to say, is they're not all liabilities of the Fed, but
because the Fed's balance sheet isn't the same size as M2.
Bingo, you got it.
Right. Okay. That's it. So we're on the same page. I want to go through that process of when you deposit. If I'm understanding you correctly, when you deposit dollars with your bank, again, it's just going to come from a liability of another commercial bank, because unless you're just going down there with physical dollars, then the banks, see, in my mind, the banks are already have the bank reserves. So let's say I go down tomorrow morning and deposit that $1,000 with Wells Fargo, or I just move it from another account. So it's still, you know, it's one bank's liability. Now it's becoming a liability of Wells Fargo. I don't see Wells Fargo tomorrow morning immediately, or maybe at the close of the day, buying T-bills with that and then using that as the asset to back up the liability. I see what happens is when I deposit that $1,000 as their new liability, at the end of the day or in real time, whatever, the Fed is simply taking the bank reserves from the bank that originally had the liability and moving it down or into Wells Fargo's reserve account. And that's the asset that backs up the liability. I think what you're saying is there's a step in between where are you getting that?
Yeah. So again, it's because not all bank deposits are liability of the Fed. It's not until the QE process occurs that they move to the Fed's balance sheet. And that's simply because if you look at, if we had a number for what the total bank deposits were, which we could say is the M2.
Does it say it's 20 trillion?
Right. The Fed's balance sheet is 8 trillion. So where's the other 12?
It's lending. It's loans.
No, not necessarily. In fact, it's not loans. In fact, there isn't enough loans. So it's actually treasury securities. I'll need to send this to you, but there's a quarterly report from the U.S. Treasury itself that actually shows that customer deposits and corporate deposits have a certain maturity, one's at three and one's at five, probably customers at three, corporates at five maturity, and that the banks actually go buy treasury securities to match that duration.
So we're just talking about the difference between base money and broad money. Right. So broad money is going to be larger naturally because they're going to lend using the base money. They're not lending out the base money, but they're just using that to back up the loans.
So think of it this way, right? When a deposit comes in, they can either lend against it to create the interest to pay the depositor, or they buy a treasury security. It's not until quantitative easing comes along and moves those treasury securities to the Fed's balance sheet does it become a liability to the Fed. If quantitative easing wasn't occurring, let's say the Fed had balance sheet was zero, right? The system still works the way you think it does. It just, the liabilities are in a different place.
Right. So, but let's just say that right now with the banking system flush with reserves.
Yeah.
When I'm going down to make that deposit again with Wells Fargo, if they already have, let's just assume $1 trillion worth of reserves on their balance sheet, why are they going out and buying the T-bill first? Why aren't they just transferring the bank reserves if they already have them?
Well, because they might not have them. Because again, there's the M2 only looks at money inside the system. So if you look at a typical treasury auction, somewhere between 50 to 60-some percent comes from foreign sources. Those aren't bank reserves. That's cash. So again, Bank of China, Bank of Japan comes and buys treasury securities. That cash enters the system and it's not reserved yet. So you're thinking of a system as a closed system, but because there's dollars outside in the euro dollar system, we have to account for that. That's where starts to get confusing. I get where you're at. I totally get where you're at. I'm trying to get you to where I'm at, but I'm having a little bit of trouble doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when I'm looking at and this gets very, very wonkish here and nerdy and geeky, but when I'm looking at a dollars coming in, then I'm looking at a foreign bank, let's say in the Cayman Islands, something like that, to use that, they're going to have a counterparty. So when I wire money, you know, they've got a counterparty that where the bank that's the intermediary bank is involved with the transaction because they're the ones that have the account with the Fed. Therefore, they've got the bank reserves. And I don't think those bank reserves need to, as far as those dollar bank reserves, need to get outside of the system in order for the euro dollar system to actually function. You know, in the Cayman Islands, I don't think they actually need those bank reserves to create dollar denominated loans, especially if the loans that they're creating are going to customers that are at the same bank, you know, because then they don't have to transfer any asset to another bank to match up with the liability, because they're not transferring the liability in the first place. And again, for the audience, I apologize, because this is getting super, super, super nerdy. This is about as deep as you can possibly go right here.
let's maybe simplify it in the way people would understand, right? Because it is important to understand that if the entire global system was reserved, then everything you're saying is perfectly correct. The problem is it's not. And we have this weird mechanism. So let's say that you and I are going to go out and buy a foreign car, right? So we go out, we co-sign on a loan, and we get dollars that in the U.S. banking system are backed by a reserve somewhere. And we go and buy that foreign car. Well, that bank over there probably doesn't take reserves. It wants cash because the manufacturer of that car can't pay its employees in cash because the foreign banking system doesn't work that way. They're not using reserves. So that becomes cash outside the system. Now, how does that cash eventually flow back? Well, that auto manufacturer can't pay its employees in dollars because they want foreign currency. So they have to go convert it to their bank who they bank with. Well, that bank has dollars and it has local currency, so it converts it. But they don't need all the dollars, so they convert it with the foreign central bank, their central bank. to get local currency, because the foreign central bank can create all the foreign currency it wants. Now the foreign central bank has dollars piling up that are not backed by reserves. They're just piling up and that becomes inflationary. So they need to get rid of them. So they go to a treasury auction and buy debt and give the treasury dollars. Now they've got treasuries on their balance sheet, which is normal, which is exactly as Jeff would say is how the euro dollar system should work. And now the treasury's got effectively naked dollars that aren't backed by reserves. And then the primary dealer banks come along and start converting them to reserves by auctioning them off. So it gets really deep and wonky here, but
what I need to think, and for the viewers, this is the last thing. We'll move on here.
But what we need is a whiteboard. We need to get the
whiteboard out. Yeah, I'm thinking through. If there's naked dollars, that means to use your term, I think that's a good way to think through it. That means that they're just transferring liabilities. So I'm just trying. What are the assets? Because they've got to transfer when you're buying that car. Those dollars are just liabilities of a bank. So what are they transferring in addition to those liabilities? There's got to be an asset transfer as well.
Well, or think about this way. How about your local credit union who does not participate in the commercial banking reserve system?
But they've got that intermediary bank.
They can't take reserves. So let's say that I bank at a local credit union and you bank at, you know, one of the major commercials and you send me money. My bank can't accept bank reserves of any form. They don't participate.
Then what's their asset?
They don't, their customer,
because if I'm transferring from Wells Fargo to a credit union, let's say, because Wells Fargo is transferring them that liability. So yeah, they got to transfer them an asset as well.
So what does the credit union do? Well, it goes out and, you know, does car loans and other type of loans to create, to back that money, but it's not a treasury or a Fed liability at that point.
Okay. All right. We're going to leave it at that, guys.
Lost everybody.
Yeah, I know. So, but for those who are still here, I think they're really going to appreciate that conversation because that is the deep dive of all deep dives right there.
Yeah, I think we went way far deeper than either of us thought we're going today.
But yeah, need, yeah.
What your comments are going to say is get the whiteboard out and bring him back.
Yeah, which we really should do on that, Steve. Yeah. But I had a few other things written down here. Let's see. Oh, you know what I want to get your opinion on is Wells Fargo axing the line of credits. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I don't think anything major is going on with Wells Fargo. I think they. In fact, I bank at Wells Fargo and I ended up talking to him inadvertently.
So do I.
Yeah. And I ended up talking about something else. I'm like, hey, by the way, what's the story on this? And they're like, oh yeah, we're getting rid of that. And we're going to actually bring back equity lines. And I'm like, what? Cause I have an equity line in my home. And they're like, oh, you don't know, do you? And I'm like, what am I supposed to know? They're like, well, your equity line is getting terminated soon. I'm like, oh, everybody's this. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. And they're like, if you have an outstanding balance, we're going to convert it into a term loan. And then in the first quarter next year, we're going to bring them back. I'm like, well, Wells Fargo makes no sense. I think you agree as a customer. I don't understand.
But there's got to be some risk reward reason they're doing that.
Yes. And this is where we go back to Zoltan Prozar, right? And if you read his reports, what he tells you is that Wells Fargo got put into the penalty box by Janet Yellen when she was the Fed chief because they had created all those bogus accounts. You remember that whole
thing,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're penalized. And so Wells Fargo cannot grow its balance sheet. So now you think, okay, what's the problem here is some of the stimulus money, most of it went to JP and B of A. And some of it went to Wells. But now the problem is Wells in the penalty box, they can't expand their balance sheet. So how do you get rid of your balance sheet?
All right. Right. Boy, that's so. And then that obviously the less they can lend, the fewer dollars are created.
And the balance sheet doesn't grow. And then now, of course, the ideal situation would be to bring Wells out of the penalty box. And then they could buy, you know, I think Zoltan said like $100 billion in treasuries, which I would be a huge fan of, as you know, as bond king, I'd be happy with that. But I'm just surprised that they haven't brought him out of the penalty box yet. They need to, because JP Morgan's getting to the size where they can't handle it. They're just getting too big.
Yeah. Okay. So the last thing that I want to get your opinion on here, and I know we're still a little short of an hour. Good. Is the central bank digital currency, because here's how I see things. And I see the system in the past where the commercial banks were almost exclusively responsible for the additional dollars being created through lending. I think we totally agree. And most of the people that we talk to on Twitter and our friends would agree with that in the macro space.
Yep.
And now I've seen us kind of, or in my mind, I see it as kind of this weird like hybrid system where if we just left it up to the commercial banks, like it was the system we had, there's no way M2 money supply would have gone up by 25% in 2020, because bank lending, a lot of the charts I've seen actually went down. So if bank lending goes down, so does the amount of dollars that are being created. Or the dollars on net total.
There was
total.
A spike in commercial lending as they pulled.
But that PPP.
Revolvers. Yeah. So that did actually occur.
But I'm talking about after PPP.
Right. The rest of the money came from us borrowing from foreign sources and putting effectively depositing in customer accounts or stimulus.
Okay. So walk me through that one.
Yeah. So when I look, so I have this really weird view. I see the world and I see all these dollars around the planet.
Right.
And what in the money supply, the M2 is just the US commercial banking system, right? But we know there's dollars in credit unions and outside the world. So when everyone sees this explosion in the money supply, they thought, oh, we are printing money. There were two key things that happened two key things that happened. One is you had major corporations pull their credit revolvers or their equity lines, because as Jeff Snyder will tell you, they got screwed in the financial crisis because they believed in the Fed. So this time they said, we'll just take all the money we can get. And they just deposit in their accounts, and that spiked the money supply. The second place came from PPP and stimulus, but it wasn't borrowed. It wasn't printed money. We borrowed it. And a lot of that money was borrowed from outside the US system, from foreign central banks and from foreign investors. And so that shows up into the M2 all of a sudden. And all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, we printed money. No, you just got to picture this global supply of dollars. And we just moved a disproportional amount from foreign sources into the US, possibly making the dollar shortage worse in the international market, which could have major ramifications later.
Right, which is you would expect to see the dollar go up in that case.
Yes.
On the Dixie.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And starting to, it's not there yet, because there are foreign dollar denominated debts, and if there's not enough dollars for them,
that's what I'm talking about.
Right. I mean,
like Brent talks about all the time. Obviously.
Right. Dollar shortages can appear anywhere. It just depends on, again, the music's playing. Who's short? Well, we don't know until we start to see things break.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So now what if we're moving into a system, which I think it's all a game of probabilities, right? There's never any certainties. I always say that. But I think there's a good probability that the Fed realizes that they're really not in control of the dollar. And now they're kind of held hostage by the commercial banking system, or let's just say other factors that they do not have total control over. So if dollars are created through the process of lending, if I'm the Fed, and if I could just wave a magic wand and say, okay, I want to be in control of the amount of dollars in the system, in the entire system, I'm going to set up a central bank digital currency. I'm going to ban cash. I want everyone in the real economy, entities and individuals, to have an account with the Fed, so that we can just go ahead and the only thing we do have control over are bank reserves, you know, or the creation of bank reserves. And if we could somehow, like Dr. Lacey Hunt says, we can take those bank reserves and turn them into legal tender, because everyone has an account with the Fed, or they can lend. They can create as much lending as they want. What I think of is the Ministry of Finance in Japan during the 1980s, right? How they basically kind of took a stranglehold of the commercial banking system, put a gun to their head and said, lend or you're going to lose your job. But in this case, the Fed would have control over that, so they could lend to whatever degree they wanted to lend into the real economy to create those dollars and have more control over it. And I think that's why, in my mind, there's a higher probability, not 100% by any means, sure, but a higher probability that we see a central bank digital currency, especially if we go into another disinflationary mode, that we see that central bank digital currency over the next maybe, you know, 5, 10 years, something. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's some credence to that. I think the first, I mean, 5 to 10 years, certainly. I think the cash ban will be the next thing that comes. And that's not going to be easy because, as you know, there's a lot of unbanked people. But if anyone's still listening and doesn't know what the term unbanked means, that means people that do not have a bank account of any form. They deal purely in cash. And I think the first step will be what you said, like the Bank of Japan, which you probably have heard Russell Napier's view is that what the first step will be, the government will effectively force borrowing to occur. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think the Fed, and we hear Powell say, like, look, we really don't want to go down that path. And so I think that will be, you know, the path, that will be the thing that they do when nothing else works. But I think the forced lending bit, well, I think that'll happen. And when,
so how would they implement that, Steve? Give me an example of that. Yeah.
Well, if cash is eradicated and the government comes out and just says, look, like Bank of Japan did, you will borrow and we're going to force you to borrow or else we can penalize you.
Well, they forced the banks to lend.
Yeah.
And then, so just anyone with their hand up just got a loan, just kind of like the GFC, you know, think of the housing, but the entire economy.
Absolutely. And that will work for a while. I think that that could actually work because that will create, right? Because if rates are so low, you know, like, I mean, we'll look at the real estate place where, you know, something you're intimately familiar with. If I can go get a 1% loan and I come to you and say, George, can you go find me some property where I can make more money than 1%, you know, than my cost of money? And you're like, hell yeah, I can. Let's go, buddy. Let's get in the car. Let's go shopping. And that creates inflation. So I think the first step will be to force lending, but you've got to eradicate cash. And they'll have a great excuse, right? Oh, only criminals use cash. So we're going to
get rid of it.
Because the danger, right? The danger is not having accounts at the Fed. Did you see what happened in China when they're trying to introduce their digital currency and they put a clock on it?
That? Yeah. That's what I think will happen with UBI.
Yeah, I think, you know, young people like, oh, I don't want cash. I want a digital currency. I want blockchain backed stuff. I'm like, you do not want this. You think you do. You think it's cool. And what China essentially did is they said, you can have, we're going to give you money, but it expires. Now, how would you like to log into your bank account tomorrow and find out, oh, tomorrow's the day that my account gets cut in half because that's the day of the month it gets cut in half.
Yeah. Velocity, Steve.
Oh, it'll create velocity, all right? Because you'll have no choice.
Yeah, right. So you think that's kind of the steps they'll take to get there?
Yeah, and I'm afraid, and I hope in my lifetime it doesn't occur.
But if
it does, the savings will cease to exist because everyone will be on the government dole and they'll have expiring money. And if they think it sounds good, it'll be absolutely miserable.
Yeah, and once that psychology shifts, then we get Gresham's Law, and then you go from, you know, a disinflationary environment to the psychology moving and people just trying to, you know, just get rid of any type of currency they have for any type of hard asset or buying more supply.
Right.
You know, if prices really start to go up, then people buy, you know, a year's worth of, you know, XYZ supplies. Because they know in a month or 2 months or 3 months that the price will be higher, and that exacerbates the problem.
Potato, right? I don't want it. I'll take anything you got. And you just take this from me.
Yeah.
And that was Weimar Republic. Nobody wanted cash. They wanted goods and services, and you couldn't get enough. And yeah, you get very high rates of inflation across the board, and that the Fed could work with that.
Yeah. And by the way, shout out to. You see this? I was a guy that attended Rebel Capitalist Live gave me that as a gift. So shout out to whomever gave me this T-shirt. Thank you very much.
You gotta send him a hat.
Yeah. Well, I gave out free Rebel Capitalist T-shirts to all the attendees and everything. But I understand Dr. Lacey Hunt's view because he's another well-known kind of disinflationist like yourself and Snyder as to what would get him to change his stance. To where, okay, I was in the disinflation camp. Now, because things have changed, now I'm in the inflation is more permanent, less transitory camp. What would need to happen for you to take that stance?
Well, I mean, if if Dr. Hunt's view, well, I want to qualify that I think some people believe that he thinks Congress is going to undo the Federal Reserve Act. I believe he's just saying if they do, and I don't know that he actually really thinks that's going to happen. But
yeah, everything I agree. Every time I've heard one of his podcasts, and I try to listen to every one, I don't think I've heard him say that they're going to. I think I've always interpreted it to him saying if they did. But I think he's under the impression that they're not going to change the Federal Reserve Act.
He gets misinterpreted as saying that is a likely probability, and I don't think that is. But if they did that, you bet I would be I'd be the number one inflationist right behind you. if you release all those reserves and the banks won't want them, they'll unload them faster than you can imagine. You'll hyperinflate, and I think that's, you know, a lot of people think, well, that's got to be an outcome, and I think there's one thing that people are missing is the dollar is a reserve currency. If we inadvertently or deliberately hyperinflate it, the whole world is going to be pissed off at us and we're going to be in a world war.
But see, doesn't that go back to what Brent talks about? And wouldn't that bail out a lot of countries and corporations who have that dollar denominated debt? That maybe not hyperinflation, well, but significant
the milkshake
inflation.
Theory, right? So the milkshake theory is pretty cool.
What I'm saying is, let's say the dollar went down to 40 on right. The DXY or something like that. You're bailing out a lot of those corporations who have that dollar denominated debt.
Right.
You see where I'm going? So doesn't that kind of ease the pressure of the demand for dollars outside the United States if the dollar goes from 90 down to 50 or 40, something like that?
It does. But as you mentioned earlier, the Fed doesn't have control of the dollar. The risk the Fed has isn't the dollar goes down, because then they could do other things with their balance sheet to try to offset that. The risk the Fed has, what if the dollar goes to 130?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, now... Well,
that's the global economy.
Now you've got problems. And what I think is really cool about, you know, Russell Napier's view, and I think, you know, Brent Johnson's view is, look, there's ways to relieve the pressure on the system, but we're all just throwing darts at the wall, wondering, like, will it be that one or that one?
Yeah,
there's
right.
A lot of great ideas. What they will be, we don't know. The only question is, I think we could really say is, we know the system, the monetary system doesn't work and it's defective. The question is, they've made it work a long time. Mm-hmm. How much longer can they go before it really does need to be overhauled? And none of us have the answer. Because when Jeff gets asked that question, which I asked him in an interview, he said, I said, Jeff, could you rebuild this? You know, if you were the Fed chair, he goes, what would you take? And he said, only if I could completely redo the system. I said, great. What would you do? He goes, well, that's the first question is, I don't know what we'd do. I'd have to go get a bunch of smart people to figure out what we need to do, because the system we have doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, I only posted one video from Rebel Capitalist Live, and it was the panel discussion that I had with Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder, and Robert Breedlove on the future of money and what the monetary system would look like. And, you know, obviously Breedlove was talking about Bitcoin, but Jeff was reiterating those exact same ideas. It's like, you know, I don't know. We've got to figure this out, but we need a new system.
Yeah, it's just like having, you know, some uncurable ailment and you're progressively getting worse and the doctors keep pumping you full of drugs and other things. And the only question is, how long can it go? Well, it's gone a long time. And I think we'll make it go longer. But what happens? I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that, you know, that we'll try, because there's nobody, the people that are rich and powerful do not want the system to go away.
Right.
But at some point, they're going to have to come up with an excuse to revamp it. And and as Jeff says, we're not even doing anything. Like, there's no research, no work even being done to construct an alternative. And the whole world's stuck on this. So it's possible, milkshake theory will come into play to bail out the system. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens after the next recession, because I think we'll have one more play with the Fed, you know, going to QE infinity and monetizing the entire commercial banking system. And then the question comes, what do we do after that? Now, when rates are zero across the board in the U.S., what do we do?
You mean across the entire yield curve?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
What will happen is the next recession, the yield curve will crash down to zero. The Fed will do more quantitative easing than we've ever heard of.
What do you think the government, what does the government stimulus and deficits look like then?
Yeah, who knows? But it won't matter. The Fed will, I mean, we thought, you know, we blushed when they did $1 trillion in March of 2020. I think we'll be doing $1 trillion in a month or more. And the Fed will literally take monetary policy as far as they actually have the legal authority to go. I think it will work. I just don't know how long it will last, because we could look at Lacey Hunt's research and say, yeah, it will work. And then it will roll over. And then that, the question then is, when it face plants again and yields in the US across the border is zero, then I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah. That's and every time you're trying to do something to kick the can down the road, you're making that inevitable face plant even harder.
Right. And then, but the U of other countries can have zero yields, but the US as a reserve, the US shouldn't. The question then will be, okay, when we are at zero and we can't move them because the Fed is now tapped out, what do we do? Russell Napier's version? Do we do CBDC? Do we do, you know, milkshake? What do we do? I don't know.
Yeah. I think in my mind, the probability is higher that they'll do something like a CBD prior to that yield curve getting just flatlined.
No, I think they'll be caught off guard.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. Yeah. We'll see what happens. So here's my last question, Steve. How does it feel when you go to the bank and talk to your banker at Wells Fargo and you know that you know about 1,000 times more about the bank where he or she works than they do?
I've actually that conversation did come up. This is actually a pretty funny story, which is I ended up needing to, I had my dad and I used to run the business together, and then he kind of retired. So it made sense. We moved all the accounts over to my name, and it just, you know, made sense to do. Well, the original credit card for the business, well, he was a primary. So I had to go get a new one. So I thought, well, I have all my accounts at Wells. I'll just go get a Wells card. It's no big deal. And I went down there. Guy's like, I'll give you a credit line of 5,000. And I'm like, do you see my bank account? Uh-huh. I can't, 5,000? That's nothing. Like, right. What if I'm in business? What if I need to spend some money? He ain't gonna do it with us, he said. I said, look, I need you to go talk to your boss. He's like, dude, he's like, I'm telling you, you're not gonna get. So they finally, he gave me a $10,000 limit. He says, you are never getting any more credit from us. And I'm like, cause you guys, you don't even know why you can't. He didn't know. He just said, it's not your.
You didn't
credit.
Start talking to him about Basel III?
Yeah, he didn't.
Maybe that would have worked. Say, you know what? I realize that you guys are constrained on the amount of lending you can do because you can't grow your balance sheet because of Basel III. You see the deer in the headlights is what you would have got.
No, because the better part of it was he's like, well, what do you do for a living? I'm like, I manage money. He goes, I want to do what you do. It gets worse. He goes, I've taken the test 3 times, failed it. But the guy over there, he points to, see that guy over there? Yeah, he's the guy that manages money here. He makes a lot more than me, and I want to do it. I'm like, dude, if you failed the test 3 times, maybe it's a sign.
Yeah, right.
I didn't bother going into anything about anything else because I feared it was too much.
Yeah, right. There you go. Would have just gone right over his head.
Yeah. Like, oh, man.
All right, buddy. Well, I sure appreciate your time. As always, a fantastic conversation, man. I really, really enjoy being able to have the opportunity to go back and forth with all of these ideas. You know, there's so few people that that really, truly kind of understand this stuff, but yet it's so important. You know, it's so important. And I think at the end of the day, none of us really completely understand the system. It's just too darn complex, but it's so fun to try to figure it out. And like I was saying earlier, it's just so important for us to try to understand these so we can better predict, you know, our opinion of what the probabilities of what the future is going to look like. So thank you very, very much for your time. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, other than going to castles in Ireland, in Scotland, where can they go?
You know, because you're right, George, I really appreciate you having me on again. And this is all about helping your viewers and my viewers protect their money. That's what we're trying to do. Yeah. We don't, like you said, we don't know exactly how the system works, but we have a really good idea. And we have some really smart friends that we can call upon, like Jeff and Lacey and Brent and everyone else. But yeah, they can find me. I've got a YouTube show, do a macro show 3 days a week, a Sunday night chart show for those who like to draw lines on charts and get into technical analysis. I've got a free daily report. It's free right now. It's a beta test. If you're into Momentum Signals. I've got like 70 some ETFs. You can sign up for that at MomentumTimerPro.com. You can check out my...
That was MomentumTimerPro.com. Okay.
Yeah, totally free right now to sign up. It's open beta. You can check out my investment strategy, PortfolioShield.net. I know you had Chris Cole on, but I've got something kind of a little different. You can check that out, or just throw my name in a search engine and you'll find me somewhere.
Okay. And your YouTube channel and your social media, you just use your name?
Yeah. My Twitter is at MeterSteven, M-E-T-R-E, Steven. I'm on Facebook. My website, steven@meter.com. So yeah, I'm all over the place.
Awesome. Steve, again, appreciate it. I can't wait to have another conversation just like this one in the near future.
Well, you know what? What you need to do is you need to have another Rebel Capitalist Live and get me on the list so I can come hang out with Jeff and you and Brent and we can really get into the weeds.
I may just do that, my friend.
That would be interesting.
All right, man. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right. Take care, buddy.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow Rebel Capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.